spirit of reconciliation, Mylomo Australia acknowledges the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to the elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today. Welcome to My Conversations, Mylomo Australia's podcast series. These podcasts are written and produced by our myeloma support nurses for people living with myeloma, their family and friends. We aim to deliver interesting and up-to-date information on myeloma in a portable and convenient way through our podcast shows. Welcome everyone to this episode of My Conversations, a Mylomo Australia podcast. My name is EJ Furphy and I'm the Senior Myeloma Nurse and Special Projects at Mylomo Australia, and I'm pleased to be your host today. Sandra Russell is a retired psychotherapist, author, wife, mother and grandmother, born in the UK and now living in New Zealand with her husband Sandy. Her life changed when she was diagnosed with myeloma back in 2013. In 2022, Sandra wrote a book, The Feeling of Cancer, a memoir on her life with myeloma. I'm very pleased to welcome Sandra today onto the show from across the pond. Welcome.
Thanks, EJ. A cold but sunny Auckland day.
Oh, it's a beautiful day here in Melbourne today. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I'm so excited that you're here. This is the first time that we've done something like this, a book review. And
yep.
A review on your memoir that you wrote last year. And it's such an honour to have you here. As a non-reader, I was really taken by your book, and it took me a record time of only 1 week to complete in between my full-time work, looking after the children and sports and everything else that goes on. So it must have been a really good read for that. Do you want to tell the listeners a little bit about the book and how it sort of came about?
Yeah, sure. It's a memoir with a difference. It starts with at the beginning of the diagnosis. So it's not your traditional memoir where it's my life story. In fact, it's the opposite. I think because I'm a psychotherapist, that was my work before I had to give up work. When I got diagnosed in 2013, I was looking for a book that would help me understand the emotional impact of living with cancer and living with a cancer like myeloma, which is currently still incurable. I thought, how am I going to live my life like this? So I started to read cancer memoirs. And what I found was there was a huge gap out there because people didn't talk about the emotional stuff. And because I have an English literature degree from way back and I have a master's in psychotherapy, I thought, well, maybe I could write about it. And I already had, I've got a pile of notebooks there because part of my training and part of my professional life was keeping notes and case study notes and notes on my reading. So I've always done that. So I started to keep notes about what was going on for me emotionally. And I was very lucky. Somebody dropped out of a place on a Master of Creative Writing in Auckland. And I got their place at the last minute. So I rushed up the road to Auckland to do this Master of Creative Writing, which takes a year. And I was about 6 weeks into it and really loving it when I relapsed. That was my first relapse. So I thought, well, the book's stuffed. And I went back into treatment. And then the following year, they kept my place for me and I went back and finished it. So what the Master of Creative Writing did for me was bring all my ideas together and help me to understand things like writing about yourself in the first person, writing about tenses, how you write about the past, how you make yourself into a character, how you find a voice. And I wanted to write the best book I could because I know whatever I'm reading, if I pick up a book and in the first couple of pages, it doesn't grab me, like you were saying, I think I'm not going to invest my time and energy into this. So I really felt there was a gap in the market that people were not talking about the emotional impact of cancer in general. And I thought, well, how come it's not being talked about? And everyone I spoke to, including people who do the same job as you do in Auckland, said it's because it's too difficult to put into words. And I thought, well, I can do that. So I did. That's it in a nutshell.
And here we are.
And here we are, 6 months on from publication. Yeah.
And I guess, like, when I was reading it, I was like so engrossed and I could feel everything that you were feeling at that time. This must have been incredibly hard for you to, you know, refeel these feelings that you felt some time ago, and have to revisit them. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, you're right. And there were certain points in the writing where it was quite painful to relive those moments. But I felt for the writing to be honest and authentic and to be open about what I was feeling, I had to kind of look at myself as a case study, like a client in a way, which I've been doing for years with other people, and really dig deep. And I knew that the most difficult bits were the bits where I had to really find the right words for the feelings. And I knew when they were right because I could re-feel it, if you like. And I do my writing in the wee small hours because I've been studying all my life with small children growing up. And also I was on heaps of dexamethasone and stuff when I was writing it. So I thought, well, I'll just use that experience of being awake in the night when it's quiet to just try. And it's a case of reliving all the feelings. And I don't think you can do that when you're going through treatment. I think it's only afterwards that you really start to think, oh my God, that was so traumatic. And I felt so vulnerable. And that feeling is still with me. You know, you can explore the feelings when you're out of the initial trauma, which I think takes a long time to process as well. I think it's ongoing. But yeah, I found some of it very painful. There were a lot of tears when I was rewriting it, but I knew if I was crying or I was getting angry, that I was actually doing my job, if you like, which was what I set out to do, which was to get the raw feelings on paper so people could connect with it. Yeah, it was.
What advice would you give to our listeners if they're interested? You know, a lot of people are into journaling now.
Yeah.
It seems to be really one of the hot things that people
it is.
Do.
I think I've seen some scientific research showing that writing actually helps recovery. That's the first time I've seen that. But I think people know that. I think talking, journaling, it's that thing where if you can put words to your actual feelings, you are bringing something together in your brain. You're actually doing something useful. Maybe useful is not the right word, something healing. And I think it's part of that self-empowerment, if you like. It's actually your story when you get diagnosed with myeloma is sort of shattered. What you thought your future and your is going to be, it's just gone. For me, that was the case anyway. I thought, well, I don't know how I'm going to carry on. And I think the act of writing really helped me find my baseline, if you like. This is my emotional baseline, and everything I believe comes from that. Once you know how you feel about things, then you can start to build up a sort of self-care routine. You can start to think, well, this is who I am now because of this. Some things have changed, undoubtedly. Some things are the same, but you can begin to explore that by writing. You can, in a way, you find yourself again. It's a recovery, but it's also a rediscovery through the writing. I think that's the beauty of it. And I never put myself under pressure. I never wrote so many words a day or got up every morning and had to do half a page. Things just came to me when I was out walking, usually, or I didn't have a piece of paper on me. Lots of things were scribbled on the backs of books and things in my handbag. But, you know, little phrases, little things I thought of, things I read that I wanted to use. So it was a real kind of mosaic I was putting together. And I think if you can journal in a way that you find things from other people, a bit like a magpie, then you can really start to garner things that are going to actually help you to rebuild, actually. Yeah.
And part of your rebuilding was the amazing support people that you had around you. You had your two children when they flew over, didn't they, from...
My daughter came from Australia,
That's right. And your son was in New Zealand.
He was married, and he had my first grandchild who had his own health problems, and he had some marriage problems. So all the sort of stuff that's normal was going on. My daughter had started living in Australia with her partner, and then this all came and just messed it all up for everybody in a way. Because I was 53 and had a thriving psychotherapy practice, my husband self-employed, we were getting on with our lives, and we weren't expecting. Who expects something like this to happen?
And
And
Sandy's
then it,
sorry,
go
Sandy's
on.
been a massive support to you.
Yeah, it's been, I don't know how we would have got through it without each other, if you like, but there is a bit in my book where I felt like we both needed looking after. When I went through my first stem cell transplant, because I've had two now, very frightening for us both. We had to take a place in a hospital out of Auckland because we were on a waiting list and the nurse said, just take it. So, you know, we had to drive away from home, completely unknown, didn't know any of the staff or anything. And he was sitting there trying not to worry. I was sitting trying not to worry. And the nursing sister came in one day and told me to give him a hug because he was looking pretty depressed, I suppose. And I just remember feeling enraged because I thought, well, who's going to give me a hug? This is happening to me. And I think
you went
I
feeling
was
great
so
at the
vulnerable.
Time. Yeah.
I was feeling really panicky and vulnerable and low. And I just wanted, I think now looking back, we need someone to take care of both of us. And we didn't want to put that on our children who've got their own lives. And so we just, the two of us, just, I don't know how we got through it really, but we did.
You did.
We did get through it.
Yep.
But we had our moments. It was very testing for us both. And I still think there are things that we don't always talk about. We both dealt with it differently. So we've been married almost 40 years, but it was very testing, very,
very
testing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And something that you've never prepared for.
No, I think the bottom fell out of our world. I always say to people when I got my diagnosis, which is another huge story, it's like a trap door opening. It's like a trap door opening. The day I was diagnosed, I'd had a sort of a pain in the top of my back for ages, trapezium muscle thing. And I'd assumed it was a frozen shoulder because 53, menopausal. And I was going to yoga regularly and I was given a yoga sort of routine to do to help my shoulder. I went to a massage therapist. I went to an osteopath. The doctor did an ultrasound, which of course is soft tissue. So we didn't really get to the bone thing. And then one night I woke up on a Friday night and my husband had been out with a work do. So he was out for the count. And I had the most terrible cramp in my back. And I remember thinking, I wonder if this is when people call an ambulance, but I've never really been through anything traumatic like that before. So I just took two more Panadol and a couple of ibuprofen, went back to bed. And in the morning I went for massage and I said to the osteopath, you can't massage my back. It's too painful. And he said, I think you need to go to the doctor. So I got my husband from his coffee shop where he was with his friends. And we dropped in at the local drop-in clinic, not very 15 minutes away in Takapuna. And they had a radiographer and the doctor sent me through to have an x-ray on that area. And the radiographer called me over and he said, you've broken your neck. And I looked at him and I said, what?
I've been shocked.
Yeah, I'm more than shocked. I actually didn't believe him. And he said, have you been skiing or did you hit your head on a swimming pool diving? I said, no, getting my shopping out the back of the car the other day, I did hit myself on the head with the boot, the hatchback. And he said, no, that won't be it. And he went really quiet. And I went back to the doctor and he'd already booked me in at the emergency department and it all just kicked off from then. And the next morning I started chemo. So talk about shock. That's what's called a traumatic diagnosis. But I always say to people, what diagnosis of cancer is not traumatic? Nobody expects to hear that. And yet it's so common. And the bottom falls out of your world because you think, I think I'm going to die now. And it's a possibility. So, yeah, very traumatic. So that's where it started.
You had another traumatic experience in the book when you were in intensive care with a viral infection and you were extremely hypoxic and extremely unwell, and you've given the reader a blow-by-blow account of what you can remember. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that
that situation? I was on my consolidation chemo sort of 6 months after the stem cell transplant and feeling actually pretty good and pleased with myself for getting through all that, which I found quite grueling, the treatment and the stem cell. And I had very bad nausea with everything. And it was like being pregnant, only 10 times worse. And then so I was feeling pretty pleased with myself. And I didn't make the link between being on consolidation chemo and my neutrophils taking a dive again. And I went out for a pizza with a friend. I hadn't been out for ages. And I don't know where I picked it up, but anyway, that was a Thursday. And on the Friday night, I had a really bad cough and a raging temperature. And by Saturday, I was in ICU at the local hospital. Luckily, they had a bed for me. And I remember being taken in on a bed and waving goodbye to the family. And I remember feeling really, really chilled, which I now know, as you said, is hypoxia, lack of oxygen. And I remember the admitting doctor kneeling by my bed and saying, "We can't give you anything to fight this. It's H1N1, bird flu. It's influenza one and influenza A and something else, the common cold it was." He said, "You're going to have to fight it yourself. All we can do is give you fluids and keep you cool." And he said, "But you do not want to go to be intubated, because once we introduce that tube into your throat, you will get more germs in your system and it won't be good news for you." So I just lay there and I remember thinking how good looking he was, actually, thinking how cute that he was talking to me so nicely, because I was really out of it. And I laid there for, I think, 4 or 5 days. And then one night, when I was just drifting around, looking out the window at the stars, I heard this raging alarm noise. And I thought, I wish someone would switch that off. And then I felt someone push me up and put a bag over my mouth. And I opened my eyes, and there were about 5 or 6 people standing at the end of my bed and a huge light on me. And the nurse said, "Breathe." And I just looked at her and I thought, "I just want to go back to sleep." And she shouted at me, "Breathe." And I took the biggest, and I thought in that moment, I'm going to effing well die. It was pretty clear. And I thought, I'm going to miss my daughter's wedding in November. And I can't believe I'm going to die of pneumonia after everything I've been through. And I took the biggest, deepest, most painful breath into my lungs, because they were completely filled with infection at that time. And I breathed into the bag and I did it again. And then they all started walking away and the machine calmed down and the alarm went off. And I didn't know until I was discharged 5 days later from ICU that they were ready to intubate me. They were waiting behind me and they're just about to put the tube down my throat. And if I hadn't done that breath, I think I would have been, I don't think I'd be here now. And afterwards, I went back with some very badly made cakes to the ICU to say thank you. And the nurse said 400 people had died of the flu that I had that year. And it was a very, that was way before COVID. So that was the biggest killer of people who came onto the ICU. And she wanted to know what I was thinking about when I did that big deep breath. And I
And what was
told her.
that?
I was thinking about that wedding. I was
That's right.
so angry in that moment about the idea of dying and missing the wedding. But yeah, that was a painful, painful breath. I saw pictures, I talk about that in the book afterwards, of my lungs, and they made me cry. They were just full of fog. It was like a foggy day in my lungs. It was just full of infection. And yeah, I'm very lucky to be here. Medical care is incredible. That's why I'm still here. So yeah. You can't make these stories up. I didn't have to invent anything for this book.
No, you
It's
definitely
all
don't.
true.
It's all true. We're going to take a short break now. We'll be back shortly. Myeloma Australia advocates for people living with myeloma. This can involve engaging with government bodies, healthcare institutions, and pharmaceutical companies to ensure that patients have access to the best possible care, treatment options, and support services. To learn more about Myeloma Australia's advocacy programs, please check out our website on www.myeloma.org.au. Welcome back to My Conversations. I'm EJ Furthy and I'm with Sandra Russell discussing her book, a memoir, The Feeling of Cancer. I'm going to read an excerpt out of your book now. Sandy and I do, however, have a cautious outing together one day. We stroll slowly, arm in arm, to our local cafe to meet with a support worker who has made contact from the National Blood Cancer Society. I can't quite believe that she's kind enough to drive from central Auckland to where we live in Devonport to meet us in person. "Anywhere you like," she said on the phone. Walking into the cafe, I feel people stare. I've draped a scarf over my neck collar, but it's so restrictive, rigid and tight, reaching up under my chin and tipping my head back. that my movements are stiff and awkward. I carefully maneuver myself into the seat in the corner, far away from others. I do feel hearted after talking to this young, empathetic, and experienced woman who is very concerned about how we both are coping and tries her best to answer all the nagging questions that have been floating around in our minds. Sitting with us in our familiar place, she brings some reassurance by spelling out details of treatments, recoveries, and ways of accessing support. Away from the white clinical walls, this meeting is more human and personal.
I just feel so humble even when I hear you talk about that now. I couldn't believe there was someone who would come. Maybe 2.5 weeks into diagnosis. I'd only just come out of hospital. My GP had visited me at home, which really terrified me because I only ever saw him at the GP practice. I thought I must be really sick. He got me off the morphine really quickly because I had a broken neck. He said, "You've got to stop taking that. It's so addictive." Good call. But I was already on the chemo and wondering what the hell was going on every day when I went in for chemo and different treatments. And she was just so lovely. And I thought, she's come all this way. I mean, I probably did cry when I got home. And she knows so much about this illness that I've got. And my husband had all these questions, and he was much more available to listen to the scientific stuff than me. I feel like I'm quite educated, but the science was just way over me. I had leaflets. I didn't know anything about blood, or what was in the blood, or the different types of blood, or how cancer works. And I just felt so overwhelmed. And I thought, if I don't learn to understand this, how can I talk to doctors? But she simplified a lot of things. And she also gave me the names of the support groups I could go to. And I talk a lot in the book about going on mindfulness courses. And I went on a gratitude course. I tried to go on things because I felt at these different support groups, because I felt like that was what was going to help me. And probably one of the things that helped me most was meeting other people, meeting other people who were ahead of me in the treatment and hearing how well they were doing. And it was also very humbling to meet people who weren't doing so well. And I made a couple of friends who didn't make it through like me. So it kept me kind of real, but it also gave me a little tribe of people that I felt understood what I might be going through, which is so important, because as I talk about a lot, there's a real sense of isolation when you have cancer, because nobody's going through it but you, no matter how good your friends and family are to you. I do think you need those kindred spirits along the way who understand, you know, that you can text in the middle of the night, or that you can say, "I've had a really terrible week too," and they don't try to cheer you up or make things better, because people really want you to be okay. But the people who are going through it like you are the ones who can talk the real talk. So finding those people is really important. And that can take time. Yeah. And she set me on that path, the support worker. She was fantastic. She gave me a little bit of light and a bit of hope. Yeah, because I was feeling very vulnerable.
Yeah. So she's the equivalent to a myeloma Australia nurse.
Yes. Yeah, she had a nursing background and she specialised. She worked with people with myeloma all day. Mm. Yeah. And so it was really, really helpful.
The support service that they have over in New Zealand is called is the Blood Cancer Society. Is that correct?
Leukemia and blood cancer, but we also have a little organization, Myeloma New Zealand ourselves, which is really great online. We all know each other. There's about 3,000 people now living with myeloma in New Zealand, and we're quite big on advocacy because, as you know, we're way behind Australia now. We don't even have daratumumab. I know you're working hard to advocate for CAR T cell being expanded, but we don't have things like daratumumab or carfilzomib, pomalidomide. We don't have those unfunded in New Zealand. So we're really behind with our funding. So we're working hard, because part of that huge anxiety of myeloma is, next time when it comes back and it mutates, will I get treatment that will work? And, you know, you're living with that anxiety every day, because none of us know. I've had my first relapse, and I'm lucky enough that I was funded for lenalidomide, which didn't exist when I was first diagnosed. And I've been on that for 4.5 years, which is incredible, really. Because my first relapse was only 3.5. So the lenalidomide's working for me, and I'm only on half a dose because of all the side effects I had. But that will stop working. I know it will. And then, is it a clinical trial? Will I have to pay for something? You know, how is that going to work? I don't know. So managing that anxiety is a big part of the whole picture of the emotional work that you have to constantly be doing. Yeah.
Should we just shift a gear now and talk about the self-care and empowerment that you talk about in your book and things that you found useful during this time?
Yeah, I started a mindfulness course with a blood cancer charity that I went along to because I found support groups quite hard for me because I found sometimes I came away feeling quite distressed and traumatized by other people's stories. And so I thought I'll do something in a group that's actually quite purposeful, if you like. So I went along to a group that was doing a mindfulness course, and there I realized when I was doing my mindfulness that I was actually really beginning to hate my own body, which I don't think is uncommon. I was deep down, I was quite angry with how I felt it had let me down and what it was going through. And I thought, well, this is not really healthy. And that was where I came across the idea of self-compassion. And I've got a good website with lots of resources on. But self-compassion was really coming through at the time as a way of generally looking after yourself. And I read some stuff about it. And what I realized it was, it's as simple as treating yourself like you would a good friend, being kind to yourself. It's not about bubble baths and, you know, self-care, buying yourself nice clothes. It's actually about treating yourself kindly. And I didn't think that I realized I wasn't doing that until I got the opportunity to really look a bit deeper. I don't think that's uncommon with women as well. So developing empathy for myself and how I was feeling on any given day, again, it all goes back to the feelings for me. If I was having a bad day, it's having the courage to cancel what I'm supposed to be doing. And I met a really close friend on one of the courses I did, who was living with stage 4 breast cancer, who sadly died last year, but she lived for 10 years. And I met her in about the second or third year of her experiences. And I was very early to all this. And I asked her how she was coping. And she said, you have to make self-care your job. It's your job. You have to do something every day for your self-care. And I really took that on board at the time. And I think that feeds very much the self-compassion, the self-care. And I did a gratitude course as well, which I talk about a lot in the book. I wasn't expecting what I got from that either. And there were only 3 of us on it. But what I got from that was on the days where I didn't feel grateful for anything, I remembered what some of the people on that course were dying. They were in the final stages of cancer. And I thought, well, if they can be grateful for getting up in the morning and having some breakfast and listening to the birds sing, then I can too. So it was feeding off other people's sense of gratitude. It's that humility again. But I also found that all of the self-compassion and self-care that I worked really hard to put in place for myself, like listening to my favorite music, going for walks on the beach, it wasn't anything fancy. It was just tuning back in with the things that I know I love, playing with my grandchildren. I've been lucky enough to have another 3 since I was diagnosed. I didn't know that was going to happen, and I didn't know that I might ever get to meet those grandchildren. So I've actually doing some caregiving for my daughter because I feel like it's a real privilege to be around those littlies while they're still small. It means I do have to be careful about infections, but you know, that's what I've chosen to do because it's important to me in my value system. And those doing what I need to do to stay well and what I enjoy doing is what is actually ultimately self-empowering. But I think you've really got to tune into where you want to put your energy in your life, because I have limited energy because I'm on drugs that make me very tired still. And I have to get up every morning and think, where am I going to put my energy today? And the other thing I've always struggled with is my independence. I'm a very independent person. I have my own psychotherapy practice. And I became very vulnerable with this illness. And I needed to depend on people more. And that's been quite tough for me. So allowing myself to do that, like take the advice from the worker you were talking about, a support worker, and really lean into those sorts of environments and go in with an open mind, has been quite tough for me to let people look after me. Really hard. And so that's why I struggle with hospital, I think, because I hate that feeling of feeling so vulnerable and like a child and all of that. So, you know, that's been a huge learning for me, and all the shame and the stigma around being ill and all the guilt about not being able to do the things that you always did before, and all of that. So I think my relationship with those feelings changes all the time. And my book is about exploring those internal conflicts that I think we have when we live with what is really a chronic illness, myeloma.
Yeah,
but yeah, it's a changing relationship you have all the time with yourself and your body and how you're feeling day by day, really, or hour by hour sometimes when you're in treatment.
I think that's really clearly reflected in the book as well, how you changed.
Yeah.
Started loving yourself again.
Yeah, I think probably the big part for me was actually realizing I wasn't going to be here forever and that I should cash my little pension in and go to Italy and have an amazing holiday. I'm so glad I did, because I relapsed when I came back very quickly, and that was devastating, because I got into a magical thinking kind of state where I thought, I'm not on any treatment, it's been 3.5 years, I've had a great time in Italy, it's not going to come back, I'm going to be one of those people who doesn't relapse for 20 years. And then my blood started to go up and I had a lesion on my thigh, and I was, yeah, that was devastating. That was really devastating. So a big lesson for me, and another 6 months of chemo and another stem cell transplant. And that was so, so hard. People always say, wasn't it easier? Because you know what to expect. 3 weeks in hospital and it took me a year or more to recover, because it really hit my body quite badly. And here I am. I'm actually feeling quite well, touch wood. But yeah, I think all of that has had something in it for me, and none of it's been easy. And it's still difficult some days and sometimes to think about it all, but none of us are here forever. And like the lady in my book on the Buddhist retreat that I went to just before COVID broke out, when everyone was, she was an amazing woman who'd been working with as a chaplain, a Buddhist chaplain in with AIDS patients who were dying in a hospice in San Francisco. And everyone was asking her how she dealt with the reality of her own death. And they were pumping her for a little pearls of wisdom, and in the end she just said, it's all gravy. It's all gravy, which is just a great way of saying, you know, everything's extra. And I kind of feel like I could have died in hospital several times. I've had my infections, I've had the flu this year, managed to stay out of hospital so far, but it was very close when my temperature went up and I rang them and they said, well, a couple more degrees on the thermometer, you should come in. And I thought, no, please no, I've been to that hospital so many times. But this year, I'm getting through the winter a little bit better. But that's because I'm being careful and looking after myself. And I've been through COVID, so I know how to look after myself better too. I learned a lot about staying well. But yeah, frightening. Frightening. It's always frightening. The fear is always there. Something's going to snuff me out. I'm not invincible, but nobody is.
So how can people get a copy of this fantastic book of yours?
Well, until I get a publisher in Australia, it's available online. You can get it through eBay Australia. You can get it on Mighty Ape and Fish Pond. So the eBay sellers will send it to Australia. And you can also, if you have a Kindle, you can download it on Amazon Kindle. And anyone who's really struggling can go on to my website, thefeelingofcancer.com, and I will send them a copy if they don't mind paying postage. But yeah, online sellers are pretty onto it. So yes, that's how you get a copy of the book.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today and for writing this book. It really is a very, very special book.
Thank you. I'm still passionate about spreading the word about the emotional impact, because I just feel it really isn't talked about or recognized, and it's huge.
It is huge, and it's really important that we talk about how we're feeling, especially at this time.
I think so too, because that's part of staying well. Yeah. Thank you so much for the opportunity, EJ.
Thanks for listening to this episode of My Conversations. We'd love to hear from you, so send us your questions or topic ideas to our email address, nurses@myeloma.org.au. Whilst the advice and opinions of our guests is welcomed, this podcast provides general information and is not intended to replace medical care or the advice of your treating team. Please talk to your doctor if you have any questions about your diagnosis or treatment. Your doctor can answer your questions, talk with you about your treatment goals, and provide you with extra support.